next case, Bush versus the United States. Mr. Weeder.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Eugene Weedoff, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellants Donald and Kimberly Bush. The Bushes, of course, were debtors in the bankruptcy case that gave rise to this appeal, and they went into that case because they were involved in a situation of financial difficulty. They wanted to go through bankruptcy to discharge what debts they could and to find out what debts they still owed at the conclusion of the bankruptcy case. With that in mind, they asked the bankruptcy court to determine the amount of any tax penalties that they would still be liable for following their bankruptcy discharge, since those tax penalties would be non-dischargeable under Section 523A7 of the Bankruptcy Code. But there was a dispute regarding the amount. The bankruptcy court was prepared to give them that decision, but in an interlocutory appeal, the district court found that the bankruptcy court lacked jurisdiction to decide the question. We believe that is wrong for two reasons. Both Section 505A of the Bankruptcy Code and Section 1334B of the Judicial Code accord bankruptcy court jurisdiction to decide precisely this kind of an issue. First, Section 505A. Its precise language is, the court may determine the amount of any fine or penalty relating to a tax. And of course, the plain language of the statute is supposed to be applied. The government argues that the context of this language somehow undercuts it, that the language appears in the bankruptcy code rather than in the judicial code where general bankruptcy jurisdiction is set out. But the problem with that argument is that prior to the adoption of the bankruptcy code, all bankruptcy jurisdiction was in the Bankruptcy Act, in Title 11. And all that happened here was that one of the specific provisions about bankruptcy jurisdiction that had been in the Bankruptcy Act was continued in the bankruptcy code. So we have general jurisdiction in the judicial code and the specific grant of jurisdiction in 505A. The plain meaning is underscored by the fact that there is no other apparent purpose for the grant of jurisdiction. The government argues that Section 505A was
Mr. Weedoff, why are you calling Section 505 a grant of jurisdiction? Why is it anything other than just a specification of a bankruptcy judge's duties? I say this because the Supreme Court has been trying very hard to distinguish jurisdictional rules from substantive ones. And jurisdictional rules, as you know, are the kind of things that we have to decide even if the parties are perfectly content.
Yes.
So why should we think of this as a jurisdictional rule?
For two reasons, Judge Easterbrook. Number one, it accords authority to determine a specific issue, and that is...
Everything in the bankruptcy code does that. Section 547 does that.
If you would let me finish, please. The other reason that I would add to what the plain language says, and again, jurisdiction is the authority to decide a dispute, there is no other apparent reason for this language being in the bankruptcy code. This does not create any new procedure for determining the amount of a claim. It does not set up...
I still don't get it. Why is any of Chapter 11 about jurisdiction? The jurisdiction of bankruptcy judges is created and regulated by Title 28, not Title 11.
Well, as I was saying before, it's perfectly permissible for Congress to put jurisdictional provisions in a place other than Title 28, which they did for getting out of 100 years
Congress can do
in
what
the Bankruptcy
it wants,
Act.
But there's absolutely nothing in Section 505 which even hints that it has anything to do with subject matter jurisdiction. I'm going to ask the same question of your adversary, but maybe you should just go back to the merits.
All right. Well, to get into what I had begun to argue earlier, there's no other apparent basis for this language being in the bankruptcy code. The only argument the government has made in response to that observation is that this is somehow a waiver of sovereign immunity. But the question of the debtor's liability for taxes does not implicate sovereign immunity, and that's the main thrust of this grant of authority.
We've held, by the way, that sovereign immunity is itself not a jurisdictional doctrine.
Well, all right, so there's a bit of a circularity here. In any event, the final point that I wanted to make as far as Section 505A is concerned is that this question has been addressed by eight other courts of appeal, and every one of them has held that it's a jurisdictional grant. Only argument that the government has made in this respect is to cite the Quattron Accountants versus IRS decision of the Third Circuit in 1990. That dealt with a completely different issue, not the tax liability of the debtor in bankruptcy, but the tax liability of a responsible person, not the debtor. And because of that, the context the Third Circuit said indicated this grant, and again, they called it jurisdiction, had to be found other than in Section 505A. But 10 years later, in Quattron versus Custom Distributor Services, the Third Circuit said, and I quote, "We have consistently interpreted Section 505A as a jurisdictional statute that confers on the bankruptcy court authority to determine certain tax claims." So certainly the earlier case was not a finding that there's no jurisdiction under 505A. Those are the reasons. The plain language accords authority to decide this question, its context supports that, and it has been held by eight courts of appeals to have that impact. Now, the second point that we raised, 505A were not in the bankruptcy code, would there nevertheless be jurisdiction here? And the answer is yes. Section 1334 of Title 28, the Judicial Code, accords jurisdiction over matters that are related to other matters in the bankruptcy case. Here, our argument is that the question of the extent of the debtor's remaining liability is related to their bankruptcy discharge. They went into bankruptcy wanting to find out what they would owe at the end, and knowing the amount of the tax penalty is intimately related to their discharge. As to this question, there is a Seventh Circuit decision decided last year in Re Colazzo, which specifically holds that there's related to jurisdiction. That is the precise language of the court's holding.
Well, that was kind of a drive-by statement, wasn't it?
Well, but it was a remand to the bankruptcy court, Your Honor, to decide precisely that issue with direction on how it ought to be decided. So although there was no extensive discussion of the rationale for the holding, it was a holding of the case, binding on the lower court.
Well, it was an issue that the lower court was instructed to address on remand.
And given directions for how to do it.
Well, not conclusive directions, right? Otherwise, why remand?
Well,
to ask the court to decide it.
I believe, and to some extent from personal experience, that when a bankruptcy court is given a specific direction from the Court of Appeals, it's incumbent on the court to follow those directions. That's why I do believe it is a holding. But beyond that, this is also a continuation of what had been the jurisdictional framework of the Bankruptcy Act. Section 17A of the Bankruptcy Act provided that bankruptcy courts had the jurisdiction to determine the amount of any non-dischargeable debt. We believe that that was carried over as Ninth Circuit held in a case that was cited in the Colazzo decision. So we have two reasons which independently show that the denial of jurisdiction here was erroneous, and the matter ought to be remanded to address them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Rito. Mr. Schofield.
Can I get some water?
Oh, sure.
Thank you. Okay.
Good afternoon. I think there are two overarching flaws that home in on the crucial aspects of this case. Two flaws in my opponent's arguments, one for each argument. They have two arguments. One is 505 is independent. One is 1334 related to jurisdiction. I'd actually like to start with the flaw on 1334, even though the briefs took them in the opposite direction because of the Collazo case. Our overarching flaw, which I think is in Collazo, which I would agree is a drive-by statement, it doesn't cite anything, is that it conflates the relationship that you have to have for related to jurisdiction with what that relationship is supposed to be. The actual relationship that's cited in Collazo is a relationship between the liability in a fraud case and the dischargeability, and they turned on interrelated facts. The relationship that's required for 1334B is very specific. It says it must be related to the case, not to another civil proceeding in the case. The case is the jurisdiction under A. Under Section 1334A, starts out saying bankruptcy courts have exclusive jurisdiction over the case. And that would be things like determining confirmation of a plan, things that nobody else can do, no other court can do, lifting the automatic stay. If something relates to the case, which is the administration of the estate, that's why courts have said, in order to relate to the case, you have to have some relationship to the estate or the distribution of the estate among its creditors. What Collazo does is conflate that and assume that because there's a relationship.
So do you think the Supreme Court of the United States acted without jurisdiction last week in Midland Funding against Johnson?
Can you remind me what the holding was?
The Supreme Court held that a claim that had no chance whatever of being paid because it was utterly spurious was nonetheless a claim in bankruptcy properly adjudicated by a bankruptcy judge.
You're referring to the statute of limitations issue, someone making a claim that was beyond the period of limitations then?
The argument about the statute of limitations was an argument under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Now I'm familiar.
But the Supreme Court resolved that by saying that the word claim in bankruptcy reaches every possible kind of claim against the estate, even though it is utterly spurious and never going to be paid. So the line in your brief, which the district court also took, that a bankruptcy judge has no jurisdiction if the claim isn't going to be paid, sounds like it amounts to the statement that the Supreme Court was acting without jurisdiction in Midland Funding or telling bankruptcy judges to do things over which they had no jurisdiction because none of those claims was ever going to be paid.
I think there's a key distinction there, Your Honor. The Supreme Court said that a right to payment, whether or not it was subject to a statute of limitations, was
an asserted right to payment. That was the whole point. It doesn't have to be an actual right to payment.
I agree, Your Honor. I'm not going to try to detract from that. I think it's very distinguishable from this case because we would agree that the claim against the estate in this case can be adjudicated. The question of whether it's a frivolous claim or not drops out very quickly. The claim can be adjudicated. There was no question in that case that the estate would have been impacted by the claim. If you go back to Celotex, and this is part of the problem, and I'm going to give you a solution to the problem as well today, I promise, about the conflict here with Collazo. But Celotex said, whatever test is used for related to jurisdiction, whatever test is used, bankruptcy courts have no jurisdiction over proceedings that have no effect on the estate of the debtor.
And therefore, Midland Funding was incorrect because none of those claims had any conceivable effect on the state of the debtor.
Yes, they would if they were allowed. That was just if they were allowed or not.
The Supreme Court said, I'm not going to argue Midland Funding with you, but the Supreme Court said that something is a claim even if it has no chance whatever of succeeding or being paid.
I agree. There was
no
a claim here.
Chance.
There was a claim here for penalties, even though it had no chance of succeeding.
Therefore,
it had a chance of succeeding initially. There was a claim here.
Trying to talk over a judge is not a paying strategy.
Sorry, Your Honor.
And therefore, the Supreme Court said the bankruptcy court had authority. And you're trying to tell us the bankruptcy court had no authority. That is, no subject matter jurisdiction. And I must say, I don't get it. I don't get the link between the likely outcome, the likely payability of a claim, and subject matter jurisdiction in the bankruptcy court.
May I try, Your Honor?
Sure.
I do believe there's a very big difference between what I'm admitting was a claim in this case, and it may have been a valid claim. They may even be right on the penalty. We don't know who's right yet, unlike the one in the Supreme Court case. There is a claim here. Here was the claim against the estate. That's not what this case is about. The claim against the estate is actually being held in abeyance right now. It was never dismissed. There was the objection to the claim. The judge held it in abeyance because he doesn't know yet whether there'll be any point in adjudicating it, and because there have been cases that have said that a debtor in a Chapter 7 case doesn't have standing to object to the claim against the estate if it won't produce a surplus. The district court agreed with that as well. The bankruptcy court held that in abeyance, and we went up on a different proceeding, a 505 proceeding, which is strictly to determine the non-dischargeable amount of the debtor's debt outside bankruptcy, not in rem, not part of the claim. In Celotex, the Supreme Court, as I said what it said, and there are 12...
I don't understand what any of this has to do with subject matter jurisdiction. All the parties' arguments may be perfectly fine. Just give up on this jurisdictional characterization of a statute that doesn't read on jurisdiction.
Well, my answer to that, Your Honor, is that I really don't think the Supreme Court overruled Celotex in saying that in order to adjudicate this claim, frivolous or not, it would have to, if it was allowed, have to have some impact on bankruptcy administration. This court has held 12 times. I have the citations, if you wish. I think it would take too long. 12 times, three by Your Honor, Judge Esterbrook, and
counsel,
two by Judge Flown.
Counsel, decisions of the court speak for the court. The person who wrote them is irrelevant.
Right. This court has held, regardless of who wrote the decision, at least 12 times that there has to be an impact on the estate prior to Collazo. But there's a way to harmonize Collazo with those 12 cases and Celotex. It's actually relatively easy. If you want to assume that Collazo allows related to jurisdiction where the non-dischargeability is determined and then you go on and determine the liability, Collazo did that in the context in which the facts were intertwined and interrelated. No court has ever, to our knowledge, allowed, certainly not since the 1978 Act, allowed a bankruptcy court to go on in a clearly non-dischargeable case or clearly dischargeable and determine the amount of the debt that's left owed by the debtor where it has no relationship to the liability determination. And to do so would bring in all kinds of new cases that have never been adjudicated in bankruptcy. State courts normally adjudicate state claims that are non-dischargeable. Here you have Congress saying this kind of debt, this kind of tax, is accepted from discharge, not affected by bankruptcy. And the question is then, are you going to let a bankruptcy court determine the amount when it's not affected by bankruptcy and there's no estate? Let's say you have a no-asset case at all, nothing to administer, nothing going on at all. Then you're bringing in all, you could bring California into Indiana to determine a California state tax that Congress said is unaffected by bankruptcy and determine it in Indiana because the debtor moved to Indiana from California in a federal court when it would normally be determined in a state court. That's not the purpose of 505. That's never been held to be the purpose of 505. That wasn't the purpose of 505 under the old Act either. And there are not eight courts of appeals that even remotely suggest that is the purpose of 505 or that you have that kind of jurisdiction. We go through those in our brief as well. The old Act essentially relied on Section 17A3, which was a dischargeability provision that said right in it, the bankruptcy court, once it has...
Okay, let me be sure I just understand your position. 505A is, except as provided in paragraph 2, the court may determine the amount or legality of any tax penalty and so on. You're not arguing that sub 2, paragraph 2, applies, I gather.
Correct.
So it's your contention is we should read this with an implicit second exception, where the implicit second exception is, it would read something like, except as provided in paragraph 2 of this subsection, and or situations in which the estate lacks sufficient funds, comma, the court may determine the amount or legality of any tax.
I would say it a different way. I would say it says, and many courts have said, the may is discretionary. The may says you can do it. And there are plenty of cases that say you shouldn't do things that are not within the subject matter jurisdiction of the court.
Look, there are completely separate questions. Does 505A allow something? And the second question is it a good idea for the bankruptcy judge to do it? As this case comes here, the only question is whether 505A allows something. There isn't a question about whether it was a good idea for the bankruptcy judge to do it.
We think that 505A only allows it where there's jurisdiction under 1334. And Section 1334 limits jurisdiction to where you're going to have one of these three.
So your argument is that there is a second but unstated exception in 505A1.
Not only would I argue that, I would argue that's an unstated exception in every provision of the bankruptcy code.
Yeah.
There are lots of provisions of the bankruptcy code that start out saying the court may do something. And the courts have universally held the jurisdiction to do it in a particular case must be found in 1334. Mm-hmm. Either the suit must arise under Title 11 itself, or the dispute must arise in the case, or it must be related to the case. I don't think there's anything controversial about limiting the bankruptcy code and what bankruptcy courts can do to situations where there's a bankruptcy purpose and where it affects either the estate or it is a determination, for example, of dischargeability, which is a quintessential bankruptcy purpose, but determining the amount of a debt left over in a no-asset case that Congress basically said will not be affected by bankruptcy doesn't seem to us to even fit within the bankruptcy clause of the Constitution. And no courts have held that can be done in that kind of a situation. The courts of appeals have not gone that far. And certainly not since 1978.
I can't be hearing the department saying that Section 505A is unconstitutional.
No,
is that what you're saying?
No, we would harmonize it by saying you should read 505A as limited to situations where there is a purpose for that determination under the bankruptcy clause, rather than read it to go beyond that purpose, because there are two Supreme Court cases that say where there are two readings, you adopt the reading that doesn't even raise a serious constitutional question, unless you're really compelled to adopt the alternative reading. We think 505A is very easily harmonized with Section 1334. There are many, many, many cases in which 505A has a purpose. So my opponent said it has no other purpose other than this. That just doesn't make sense. 505A overrides administrative res judicata. It overrides cases where the other courts have held against the taxpayer in a default judgment because it allows creditors to object to the claim as well. It has many purposes besides the refund purpose in 505A2. It has many purposes in 505A1. It allows the determination of the actual merits of the tax that are normally not allowed in a claim objection proceeding. If you look at probate case law, there's no ability, even when the IRS files a claim, to look beyond the procedural requisites of the assessment. In order to get to the merits of the tax, there's got to be a separate grant, and I don't call that a jurisdictional grant. It's a grant by Congress to go to the merits of the tax in that context. It exists in the Internal Revenue Code for state court receiverships. It exists in the bankruptcy code in 106's reference to 505A. It doesn't exist for probate cases. It's been held not to exist for interpleaders. It's been held not to exist for mortgage foreclosers. You can't look at the merits of the tax when a senior mortgagee is foreclosing, or even a junior mortgagee who would like to attack the senior tax claim. They don't have the right to look beyond the procedural compliance with the code to reach the assessment. So there's two very good reasons for 505A. One, it allows looking at the merits of the tax in a claim objection. Two, it allows looking at the merits of the tax in a refund suit. Three, it allows overriding default judgments and state proceedings that have state. A lot of states have rules that if you don't contest the tax within a certain time period, you're out, period. Unlike the federal government, which lets you then sue for a refund if you pay it, or lets you defend in a collection suit by the United States against that. There are states that have administrative res judicata, and there's legislative history that says that's one of the purposes of 505 is to override that. That legislative history actually goes back to 1966 when Section 2A was enacted, which, by the way, was not in 1970, when it was the first time that bankruptcy courts ever got jurisdiction to determine dischargeability and go on to determine the merits of the judgment. So there are lots of ways to harmonize this, and you can harmonize it with Collazo by noting that Collazo did have this intertwining. Hallahan is a great case. The other side cites it for their position. I think it supports ours. Hallahan doesn't mention 1334B. It cites two bankruptcy court cases that allowed a court to determine the non-discharge, excuse me, the amount of a non-dischargeable debt, and both those bankruptcy court cases those are, by the way, those are cited are Schmid and DeWitt. Those two cases cited in Halligan both say that the debt in that situation was inextricably intertwined, one said. Another one said inseparable from the determination of the dischargeability because the two turned on the same facts. That's the way to distinguish Collazo so you don't have this conflict with 12 prior Seventh Circuit cases that all agree with Celotex saying you have to have this effect on the estate. And thank you, Your Honors.
I don't want to cut you off, but if you had a concluding remark, but you're a little over the time.
I have one very short concluding remark. If you are to reverse, we request that you remand with instructions to consider the abstention decision that the district court never reached.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Madoff, you may have an additional 3 minutes to add it to your rebuttal.
I would like to just make a couple of points. First, as far as Section 505A, what it says is that the court with bankruptcy jurisdiction can determine the amount of any penalty. The amount of a penalty is almost invariably one that's not going to affect the distribution of the estate. In every no asset Chapter 7 case, there's no impact about the amount of the penalty.
Right. How is your argument that 505 is an independent jurisdictional grant reconcilable with Section 105C?
105C doesn't determine anything regarding the tax liability of the debtor.
Well, I recognize that. It's a general provision that says you got to have jurisdiction under 1334
505C.
To exercise any authority.
I didn't read it that way.
The ability of any district judge to exercise any of the authority conferred or other court, that is the designated bankruptcy court, under this title, Title 11, shall be determined by reference to the provisions set forth in Title 28. So you have to have 1334 jurisdiction before you can use the 505 power.
Your Honor, Judge Sykes, I have to confess that I don't have the statutory language in front of me, and this is not a question that I looked at. If the court would like a supplemental statement on this, I'd be happy to provide it.
Yeah, it's just the standard power of the court provision, which I know you're very well acquainted
well,
with.
Well, this is just not a point that came up in any of the argument or any of the cases that I read, so I have to apologize. Now, the other point that I wanted to make very briefly is that the argument that the government has made regarding 1334 related to jurisdiction tries to avoid Collazo by saying that was really supplemental. The only basis that the court had in Collazo for allowing the case to go forward to adjudicate the amount of the non-dischargeable debt was that the factual situation between non-dischargeability and the amount of the debt was so overlapping that there was supplemental jurisdiction. This court has never recognized supplemental jurisdiction in bankruptcy, and its decision in Town Square Media versus Brill 2011 case expressly stated that. And there was no indication in Collazo that there was going to be, for the first time, recognition of supplemental jurisdiction in bankruptcy. I thank the court.
All right, thank you, Sweetheart. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.